proliferated across the continent of Africa during under colonial rule and remained a feature there even after the end of colonial rule. And that pathology of focusing on disease control over care, I think, really weakened the epidemic.
Dr. Paul Farmer, author of the new book, Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. He's chair of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School, co-founder and chief strategist of Partners in Health, also featured in the documentary Bending the Arc. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, Aaron Dooley, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
PM. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up next is an encore presentation of KBOO News in Depth. Then at 5:30, stick around for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The KBOO Evening News is off this evening, and instead we present to you a look back at some of our favorite News in Depth pieces. Tonight, we will be reflecting on the disparate ways that the coronavirus pandemic has impacted our communities.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had disparate impacts on people of different groups. One such group are those affected by the opioid crisis, who face increased accessibility issues during closures related to the pandemic. Social distancing can make it harder for them to prevent overdoses. I spoke to Dr. Sheila Vicaria, who is the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance, to learn more.
So you work at the Drug Policy Alliance. What have you seen to be the relationship between the coronavirus outbreak and the overdose crisis?
What we're starting to see on the ground and what we've been hearing from folks is that the very conditions that have created the situation that we're in terms of the overdose crisis, the structural and social and policy challenges that have led to rising inequality, lack of access to health care, lack of access to housing, mass criminalization and mass incarceration, those very same challenges that are fueling the overdose crisis are in a lot of ways the same exact challenges that are also fueling the harms associated with the COVID pandemic right now. And unfortunately, a lot of the same communities that are being marginalized by the very policies that are putting them at risk for overdose are going to be experiencing even more risk to their health and well-being because they're also at risk for COVID-19.
So specifically, what are those contributing factors?
Sure. So one of the things that we know that drives overdose risk is using alone or using and not having someone around who can respond with naloxone or Narcan or not being able to call 911. And what we know is that good overdose prevention education in communities tells people always have a buddy, always make sure to have naloxone on hand, and you know, if you're concerned about someone's well-being, call 911 to get help. And what we're seeing is that in light of COVID-19, what we've been recommending to folks, unfortunately, while it's good for prevention of COVID-19 exposure or transmission is going to be putting folks at risk for overdose, because we're encouraging folks to socially distance, which may mean isolating from others so that people are actually perhaps using alone. It may mean that the very programs that are distributing naloxone and sterile syringes are now limiting their hours and exposure so that people are less likely to have naloxone on hand when they do need it. And that it also means that 911 and emergency response has to rightly prioritize potential people who are struggling with COVID infection. And so it may mean that those who are calling with other medical emergencies may have delayed response times, which can actually mean the difference between life and death in the case of an overdose.
Right. And you spoke to this a little bit, but how does that limitation on non-essential medical treatments impact things like the overdose crisis?
Well, it differs from state to state in terms of whether, harm reduction services such as syringe service programs that often distribute sterile equipment and naloxone are able to stay open or not. And it can differentially impact people in states where, unfortunately, those programs are deemed non-essential, so that people may now all of a sudden go from having access to not having access at all. But even in states where we know that syringe service programs and harm reduction programs are deemed essential, we are still seeing that these programs are having to adapt to the risk environment that they're in, and that they're having to modify their service structure, they're modifying their schedules, they're perhaps not open during all of the same hours or all the same days or in the ways that they were before, which means that at the end of the day, that the folks using those services are going to be most at risk for not being equipped to protect themselves and take care of themselves. That's kind of one of the challenges that we're facing, is that whether they're deemed essential or not, can mean that people may or may not have access. But even in states where they are deemed essential, unfortunately, they're still not functioning at the full capacity that they were pre-COVID.
Right. You know, according to the Oregon Health Authority, an average of 5 people in Oregon die per week from opioid overdose. And that's, you know, outside of the coronavirus outbreak. So sure. Given the constraints of the COVID-19 pandemic, what can health officials and policymakers do to better respond?
So there are some policies that have been changing at the federal level, which are heartening and potentially can do a lot of good. You know, one of the things that we do know to help prevent opioid overdose and reduce the risk of lethal overdose is getting people who have opioid use disorders access to evidence-based medications such as methadone and buprenorphine. And prior to COVID-19, policies were incredibly restrictive, and some would argue that they still are today. That only certain licensed prescribers can prescribe buprenorphine, that you could only get methadone by visiting your clinic daily, that you had to be initiated onto these medications through in-person consults, that oftentimes there's a counseling requirement that requires you to show up in person. And a lot of these barriers can actually restrict access and have still continued to drive overdose deaths before COVID-19, but are now risk factors for putting people in situations where they're going to be congregating and going to treatment providers. And so SAMHSA, the DEA, several larger federal governing bodies recently just changed some guidelines to make it easier for people to get onto these medications and for those who are currently taking these medications to stay on them. So one thing that's been positive that's rolled out is loosening the number of days that people have to come in to get dosed on methadone and allowing people to get up to 14 days of take-home medications, if not upwards of 28 days to take home. And we know that the more you can stockpile on your medications and not have to go in to get your medications at your pharmacy or at your clinic, the more likely you are to reduce those exposure points where you might be congregating and perhaps getting exposed to COVID-19. And so, you know, one thing that states can do and places like Oregon can do is ensure that methadone clinics and buprenorphine providers are fully taking advantage of these loosened restrictions so that clinics are, to the maximum extent possible, allowing these take-homes up to 14, if not 28 days. Because what we're hearing is also, unfortunately, across the country, even though these larger federal guidelines have changed state to state, but even within states, at clinic to clinic, some of these policies aren't really being implemented to the fullest extent they could be. And what ends up happening is that it still means that people who are trying to get on these medications and stay on these medications, which can reduce the risk of lethal overdose by 50%, are unfortunately still being subjected to having to go into programs where they might be exposed to the virus. So, you know, doing whatever we can at the city and the state level, but also on the clinic level, to make it easier for people to get on these medications is a huge step in the right direction to address the overdose crisis and to continue to try to do the best that you can. The other thing that we need to consider is that even in light of restricted potential hours of syringe service programs, how do we develop novel strategies, perhaps mail-based strategies, to send people injecting equipment, but also naloxone, to their homes directly? And we've been hearing some really promising stories coming out of states like New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio with mail-based naloxone access, really making it so that people don't have to leave their homes to get this medication, so that they can potentially reverse an overdose in case they witness one. So, like, policies like that can be really, really helpful in terms of reducing the risk of overdose.
Yeah, expanding what that idea of access looks like. So obviously those you know, the restrictions that we would deal with in a normal time, those are based on a certain, I don't know, view of, you know, opioid use. Do you think that is changing at all, or that, you know, the idea of what is accessible enough will change?
We really hope so. I think, you know, so much of the restrictions around these medications were grounded in fears of, you know, illicit diversion of these medications, or fears that people couldn't be trusted to take home their doses without overindulging. And really, I think a lot of those fears have not been grounded in the reality of so many people who take these medications dutifully every day, who just want to be well, who just want to be able to do the things that they want to do in their day-to-day lives without feeling restricted by, you know, having to report back to a program. So, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, a decade-long overdose crisis didn't drive these policy changes in medication access, but it had to take a pandemic to do so. And there's many of us on the ground who are saying, you know, perhaps even these policy changes were a decade too late, but we're grateful to see them now. And sure, that hopefully what we'll see is that it'll end up saving a lot more lives during this crisis, and that we'll learn our lessons, that patients can be trusted with their medications, and that, you know, the sky didn't fall when we loosened these restrictions, and perhaps this means that we need to change business as usual. Absolutely.
So what is one thing that you think is maybe misunderstood about the overdose crisis and how it intersects with coronavirus?
I think that people often forget that many people who use drugs are very much the same exact populations who we should be concerned about, who have those very high risk factors that we've been talking about in terms of the populations that we should be protecting. A significant number of people who currently use drugs often do have co-occurring physical health challenges, if not are immunocompromised. And these are the exact people who we've been saying from the beginning need to be afforded more protections and more allowances to be able to reduce their exposure to this virus. And so when we think about COVID prevention and we talk about sheltering in place, for instance, we have to remember that a significant portion of people who are homeless or unstably housed are often also people who use drugs and who are often also people who are immunocompromised. And so when we think about even in, you know, simple suggestions or seemingly simple suggestions like shelter in place, some of those very same guidelines are actually not feasible for some of the most marginalized people in our communities. And so we need to think of novel strategies, right? And so there are cities across the country that are having real and frank conversations. You know, how do we allocate, you know, vacant hotel rooms to the most at risk in our communities? Because even shelters and expanding shelters will not be the solution if people are still forced to congregate and can still be breathing in the same air as one another, right? So we need to remember that, you know, certain guidelines that we've made still may not be feasible for all people? And how do we make sure that when we make these guidelines that we truly are protecting the health of everyone? You know, and so when I gave the example of access to these medications, you know, one of the biggest messages that we've been sending to everyone with complicated health problems for which they're receiving medications is, you know, try to get the maximum amount of your prescription available so that you can reduce your time going back to the pharmacy. And unfortunately, we've forgotten the fact that the one medication that we actually say saves lives of people with opioid use disorder is one of the only medications for which you actually have to continue to go back several times a week to get, right? So, you know, remembering that, you know, certain policies may have to look different, or we might need to adapt our policy recommendations, or at least acknowledge that other groups are going to need more support to even engage in some of these practices that we want to do to help them stay safe.
Well, Dr. Vicaria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Dr. Sheila Vicaria, the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance. More information on the Drug Policy Alliance is available at drugpolicy.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are listening to a KBOO News in Depth special focusing on the impact of coronavirus on our community.
Movie Jaws and the Discovery Channel's Shark Week, sharks sadly have a very scary but undeserved reputation with humans. What you might not be aware of, however, is that ingredients from sharks are part of many products that we humans use, including vaccines. With all the focus on finding a vaccination for COVID-19, scientists and conservationists are now concerned about the potential need to kill hundreds of thousands of sharks to produce a vaccine against COVID-19. Stephanie Brendel is the founder and executive director of Shark Allies in California, and I spoke with her recently about the effort to create awareness and convince pharmaceutical companies to consider alternatives. Stephanie, can you tell us how and why shark ingredients are used in vaccines and other products?
Yes, a shark oil is turned into shark squalene, and squalene is used in cosmetics and also as an adjuvant in vaccines. It has been used in flu vaccines before. It's not in every vaccine, but an adjuvant basically is used in some vaccines that it serves as a booster. It stimulates the immune system, and it also allows for less of the antigen to be used. So essentially, all the antigen will go a lot further and can make more vaccines. So adjuvants are a great thing. The problem is when an adjuvant that is potentially needs to be used for a global supply is based on a wild animal population, then that is potentially, well, it's unsustainable over the long range. It may not be immediately, you know, a problem. And nobody's going out and instantly killing 500,000 sharks. That's a little bit of a misunderstanding from headlines. We understand that nobody is out there to hunt them down right now. But the problem is that the vaccine market is so, it's not very transparent where and when sharks are used and how many will be in production. If it's not very likely that, that you know, all the vaccines for COVID will have shark adjuvants in them. But the problem is that we have coronaviruses for many more years to come, and each time there's a new vaccine developed, and maybe it will have to be given seasonally, it just continues and multiplies the problem, basically.
So are there non-animal alternatives to shark squalene that can be used, and are they just as effective?
Yes, from all the research and from all the communications that we've had with scientists and chemists and even vaccine and squalene producers. First of all, yes, squalene can be made from many sources, many plant sources, algae, yeast, bacteria, sugarcane, amaranth, olives, that all those plants can make high quality squalene. The way squalene becomes vaccine grade is really lies in the purification process. And that is similarly difficult or easy, whether you take it from a plant or from an animal. But essentially, by the time oil gets turned into squalene, the compounds and the parts of that is exactly the same, whether you use a plant or an animal. And obviously for cosmetics industry, they've already been switching over to plant-based squalene in many cases because it is, people are more conscientious about it. And it is as effective. And from just the most recent conversations I've had with alternative vaccine producers in the biotech area, they say that the vaccine, that the squalene that they can produce, they can do a billion doses a month, and it is fully controlled, synthesized sugarcane squalene that can be reproduced at the same level over and over again. It's scalable, and apparently it can directly replace shark squalene in adjuvants and not just in cosmetics. So the alternatives are available. It's the willingness to switch over and let go of what has been done. Change is always hard. There's always cost involved. We don't say that it isn't, but the excuse that it is cheaper and easier to do is really not usually how conscientious.
Right. I was going to ask you, why is it that the pharmaceutical companies won't consider using these alternatives first? It just seems like it would be the right thing to do.
I think it's just been available and hasn't been questioned. And I think that nobody has necessarily done it out of ill will. I don't think anyone is going out and going, I'm going to kill some sharks to make potions. You know, I think it's just been available. Maybe the awareness that what impact it has, part of it is not being aware, doing business as usual, not seeing the reason why one should switch, and also the perception that shark oil and squalene is easy and cheap to come by, and they're being told that it's sustainable, it's just a byproduct, don't worry about it, those sharks would die anyway.
So they're being told that by the fishing industry?
I mean, that's generally what happens with all shark products. You know, don't worry about the fins. We're catching them for meat anyway. And then the meat guys say, well, you know, we're catching meat sharks, but if we don't sell the fins, it's not worth it. And then the cosmetics industry will say, oh, don't look at us because the fin guys are much worse. The vaccine guys say, oh, don't look at us because the cosmetics guys are much worse. The fact remains that the target list of sharks for shark liver oil is pretty extensive, and a lot of those sharks are endangered species or on CITES listings, and only a few of them are meat sharks. So what are those sharks being taken for in the first place? Well, maybe they are being taken for fins, and then the byproduct are livers, but that's a problem in itself. You know, one bad product justifying another product doesn't make it a good product. Two wrongs don't make a right. That is the problem. Each product that you take from the animal encourages this overfishing of sharks, and of 100 plus million sharks being taken globally every year. So everybody likes to point at someone else, but I think each industry has to own their own responsibility, especially when there are alternatives. We're not losing human lives. We're not holding up a vaccine. Nothing bad happens to humans if we replace this adjuvant with plant derived. There are solutions, and that's what we're getting at.
Well, you touched on this a little bit about the shark finning industry for shark fin soup. A lot of people are aware of that, and their fins are just cut off sometimes, and the sharks are thrown back into the ocean to die. Maybe they are used for meat. But the extraction and harvesting of sharks for vaccines can also be like equally as cruel for expediency, right? Can you explain how this happens sometimes?
In some cases, we've become aware of this practice of livering where sharks that that are pulled up that they could technically just let them go because they're not good for meat or for fins, but they are being, you know, their livers are taken. And of course, when you cut a shark open and take their liver, they die. Especially in the commercial fishing industry, things happen very quickly. They don't take great pains to make sure the animal has a peaceful
humane death. Yeah.
It's pretty quick slice and dice and throw the rest away. But, you know, whether it is a byproduct or whether it is targeted, the fact that, some of the rarest deep water species of sharks that are really not edible, but they have extremely large livers, if they're not already being targeted, they could surely be targeted, because when you have an animal that has 20 to 30% of their body weight is liver, and that mm-hmm. liver is filled with oil that you want, somebody that, you know, especially people that don't value sharks as any important, and it's just some product that they want to get, it's a very easy incentive to get that animal that could normally be let go if it was bycatch, or that wouldn't even be targeted.
You know, I want to circle back to something you touched on a little bit ago. To give people some perspective, you and other conservationists, activists, and scientists are involved in trying to stop this use. You're not in any way saying that the sharks are more important than creating a vaccine or than saving human lives. Can you explain a little bit your position on this?
Sure. I think the knee-jerk reaction immediately is when you say, please don't use this in such and such product, immediately people shut down and say, you're taking something away from us, or you're trying to put sharks in front of human health or human survival. In this case, that's not at all the case. And in the case of the vaccines, we didn't even start this until we knew that there are viable alternatives. So really what it means is that we can take care of humans and of sharks at the same time. Not a single person will have to go without a vaccine because we're working on this campaign. We've said from the beginning, if the first round of vaccines have to contain shark because this is where the testing is going, well, then so be it. But what we're saying is the sooner we are starting to look at alternatives, because then they have to be tested, and then the industry has to accept them. And then, you know, agencies like the FDA have to approve things. There's still a long road to go. And the longer we wait, the more we rely on this resource that is very limited. And that limited resource will become more limited. And then it's also not really a secure supply. And it will get to the point where the price of that oil will go up because it becomes more rare. And then it also could limit how many doses you can make. What if the very best COVID vaccine turns out to be the one that is adjuvanted? Wouldn't it be great if we could mass produce it like crazy, consistently, from something that we don't have to take from a wild animal, that doesn't have to be overfished? Wouldn't that be a much better solution? Because in the end, that would be better for humans too, because we would know it is something we can reproduce over and over and over. When people talk about harvesting sharks, it's a really bad term, because we don't grow sharks, we just go out and get them. And harvest implies that it's something that you can just, that grows back, and it doesn't. So we can't farm them, we can't grow them, they don't grow back their liver, they don't grow back their fins. And the recovery and restoration of shark populations in the ocean is very slow. Once you take out a whole generation of breeding adults, it takes a long time for new adults to come along, because the way they grow and mature, more like mammals, you know, when you think of whales or humans, they have to be in their teenage years before they have young, and then they only have, you know, a litter every other year potentially. So this is not like tuna, who, you know, tuna reproduces within the first year and thousands of eggs. So if you leave tuna, and even they are endangered, but if you leave them alone for a couple of years, they can bounce back fairly quickly.
Right.
But sharks do not, because they evolve to be hunters, not to be hunted.
Sharks, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, they have a little bit of a PR problem. Can you explain why sharks are so essential to the ecosystem of the ocean, and how endangered are some of the species at this point?
Well, our planet is covered by ocean 70%, and it's the engine of our planet. So what happens in the ocean is very important. To have biodiversity in the ocean is incredibly important, because you know, we've done a pretty bad job at keeping that biodiversity on land, but then we invent things like, okay, farms, fences, you know, even robot technology. We kind of try to make up for our shortcomings on land. We're not going to be able to do that in the ocean. Sharks have evolved over millions of years to fill a very important part in most ecosystems at any depth and in any part of the ocean. And they're the regulators. If you can think of them as the white blood cells of the ocean, where they take out the diseased, the dead, the dying, they make sure that, you know, diseases won't spread to other populations. This affects everything from the very largest animals down to the coral reef, because it affects reef grazers, and which then affect algae growth and coral. So you take sharks out of the equation, it can have a cascading effect all the way down to maybe the crustaceans and the food fish that you want to catch. So you can absolutely not love sharks, but still see how important they are.
Right. Well, and it's good to get in front of it before the system already gets moving.
I mean, with endangered species, what is our track record? We are always complaining and doing nothing until they have to be on the list. So we're saying, why don't we get ahead of a problem for once? I mean, we're not even really truly ahead. We're just sort of potentially have a chance to redirect this. But why do we have to wait until we have definitive proof that, yes, this is going to be a bad thing?
If you'd like to learn more about the shark conservation effort and the use of shark products in COVID-19 vaccines and other products, you can go to sharkallies.com. For KBOO News, I'm Michelle Coppola.
This has been a KBOO News in Depth special on coronavirus's impact this year. Thanks to Michelle Coppola, who contributed to this report, and thank you to everyone who has helped with our volunteer-produced newscast this year. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Thank you, KBOO supporters, for helping us reach our end-of-the-year fundraising goal. KBOO only exists because of you, our KBOO community. So thank you for keeping these airwaves going and supporting volunteer-powered community support.